Please welcome to the stage the Deputy Executive Director for the Denver Office of Public Health and the Environment, presenting the Certifiably Green Award, Ann Williams.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for inviting me here today to recognize the sustainability efforts by Denver Economic Development and Opportunity when planning the Mayor's Housing Forum. And while I'm here, I'd like to also share a little bit about Certifiably Green Denver, one of our programs at DDPHE. For 10 years, the Certifiably Green Denver program has recognized local businesses and nonprofits for their commitment to protecting the environment. We know that sustainability is more than just a trend. It's good business. And the Certifiably Green Denver program makes it easy to go green. Our expert advisors work with organizations and events like the Mayor's Housing Forum to help achieve sustainability goals. This year, Denver Economic Development and Opportunity worked with one of our advisors to make the Mayor's Housing Forum a certified green event. With the assistance of an event organizer and the Hyatt, the event you are attending here today is reducing waste sent to the landfill by recycling and composting, serving local foods, and reducing energy and water consumption. Now, it is my pleasure to present this Certificate of Environmental Excellence signed by Denver Mayor Michael B. Hancock to Eric Haraga, Executive Director of Denver Economic Development and Opportunity. Congratulations.
Thank you, Ann. I am truly honored to accept this award on behalf of Denver Economic Development and Opportunity. We are so proud to make this housing forum a certifiably green event. And actually, we are not wasting any food here today. The untouched food at this event will go to the Food Bank of the Rockies, and actually, the scraps will all be composted. Thank you. I think that's a great achievement. Thank you to the Hyatt for helping us get there. We're also grateful for our partners at the Denver Department of Public Health and Environment to help us achieve this milestone. This forum is by far the biggest event that we host every year, and this recognition means a lot, as our entire office holds a high value for sustainability. And we set an awfully high bar today for future events. So, Ann, you have our commitment that this will be a tradition for all of our agency events. So, thanks again, we are honored. What an incredible day we are having here, starting off with the mayor's big announcement for a standalone housing agency department, housing and homeless services department, I would say. And I can't think of a better leader than Britta Fisher to take the helm. Britta, thank you for your leadership. Thanks again to everyone for joining and participating. And again, we really need to acknowledge our sponsors. Wells Fargo, our host sponsor, Freddie Mac, for sponsoring this lunch. Thank you. We would also like to acknowledge our breakout session sponsors, Colorado Housing and Finance Authority, GHC Housing Sponsors, PK Management. Thank you very much. And our scholarship sponsors. We were able to provide over 50 scholarships this year for residents and community members to attend this event at no cost to them. Thanks to our scholarship sponsors for making this possible. BBVA Compass, Urban Ventures, Fagree Baker Daniels, Gorman & Company, Housing Colorado, and the Urban Land Conservancy. Thank you very much. So, Denver Economic Development and Opportunity, DITO, formerly known as OED. Get used to it. We're DITO now. DITO's vision is to lead an inclusive and innovative economy for all residents and neighborhoods in Denver. We do this through developing local and global business opportunities, connecting people to jobs, helping small minority and women-owned businesses, creating and preserving affordable housing, as well as working within our neighborhoods with both residents and businesses to ensure they can be successful as the environment around them is changing. As we know, housing is such a key driver that connects to so many other issues. I hear from many employers on the importance of preserving affordability as it strengthens their ability to recruit and retain workers. On that note, I'm so proud that each of you is a part of this fifth annual Housing Forum, as you're playing an important role in helping build on our current approaches while innovating future housing solutions. I hope you enjoy our upcoming luncheon program and the afternoon sessions. Lastly, I'd like to thank the mayor for his leadership, city council, our housing advisory committee for elevating the city's resources around our housing agenda and helping us get what we need to be successful. And now, I am pleased to introduce our next speaker, Cassandra Skidanov, from our luncheon sponsor, Freddie Mac. Cassandra is an affordable lending manager in Freddie Mac's single family division. The affordable lending team is committed to ensuring Freddie Mac has the offerings to support responsible lending and provide sustainable home ownership and to improve access to credit for all borrowers. Cassandra built a 15-year career in mortgage, real estate, and community relations. She joined Freddie Mac last year, where she continues her dedication of supporting democracy in housing and increasing production and sourcing in at-risk areas, including multicultural and low to moderate income homes. Please join me in welcoming Cassandra.
Thank you for that warm introduction. I sometimes become a little bit embarrassed when people read my entire bio, because when it comes down to what I do with Freddie Mac, I think I have similar feelings everyone here in the room is that we are here to ensure that people have equal access to housing. Am I right, everyone? So I've been so happy to come here today and meet and talk to so many people who are on the ground level to ensure that we do have democracy in housing, that we do have the availability for our teachers, for our police officers, for our low to moderate income individuals to be able to realize the dream of home ownership. Because in this country, one of the things that we know is one of the pathways to building wealth and success and being able to pass it on to your children is through home ownership. So home ownership should not be something that is preserved for the wealthy and the well-to-do. Home ownership is something that should be accessible to all of our families and all of our communities. So I do want to commend everyone here in Denver for being able to be here on the ground, reaching out into your communities and doing what you can to make sure that pathway is accessible. So I want to thank you all for having us here, and thank you so much for your fight to be able to do that. So with that said, I am going to introduce Ms. Sarah Michelson. Now, I had the opportunity of sitting next to Ms. Sarah Michelson over the last, 30 minutes or so, and we had a wonderful conversation about home ownership and what we need to do here in this country to make sure that we preserve this availability to our families and communities. And I am very happy to introduce her here today. I'm not going to embarrass her by reading her bio, but what I am going to tell you is that she is a true believer, and she is someone that we should be honored to have to be able to give us her information, because any little bits of information like I learned from her today, I can take home and I can use that to further my fight. So everyone, please give a hand to Ms. Sarah Michelson.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here today. I am here to share a little bit about what's happening at the federal level in Congress and how that directly impacts the work that you're doing here in Denver and beyond. So we're coming together right now as a housing movement for a housing movement at a really critical time. At the same time, we're seeing extremely dangerous threats to housing programs and the people that they serve, but we're also seeing new possibilities. So we all know that the housing crisis is continuing to grow, most severely impacting the lowest income seniors, people with disabilities, families with children, and others. Homelessness in many communities is becoming more visible than ever before. Our public housing stock is crumbling and in poor conditions. And despite the need, only 1 in 4 people who are eligible for any sort of housing assistance are getting the help that they need. In large part, that's because Congress has continued a decades-long process of underfunding programs that serve them. And to make matters worse, we now have an administration and some policymakers in Congress that have put forward proposals that would cut housing benefits through funding cuts, through rent increases, time limits, work requirements, and other burdensome requirements that would just push low-income families into deeper poverty. HUD has shamefully walked away from its obligations to enforce fair housing and promote communities that are free from discrimination. And just yesterday, the administration announced a proposal that would cruelly break up families and destabilize communities by forcing mixed-status families that include some undocumented people to choose between their family and keeping it together or keeping a roof over their head. But despite the very difficult challenges that we have, housing advocates and our congressional champions have achieved so much in the last 2 years. Thanks to all of your advocacy here in the room, last year at around the same time, we achieved a 10% increase in HUD's budget, a feat not seen since the financial crisis. And a 10% increase on its own is very impressive, but when you consider where we started the process when Trump proposed a 15% cut to HUD programs, that really puts that gain into perspective. That win was followed this year by us securing that same funding increase, which translates into about 50,000 new vouchers for low-income people with disabilities, veterans, and youth experiencing homelessness. Because of all of our advocacy here in the room, an additional 30,000 people experiencing homelessness now have homes, thanks to increases in the McKinney-Vento program. And there are 1,000 new homes for poor seniors built with the first Section 202 dollars for new construction in 8 years. We have a very long way to go, but we have turned the corner finally and are starting to see a reverse in the decline in federal investments. This past year, Congress also protected funding for the National Housing Trust Fund and laid the groundwork for a major expansion in legislation through GSE reform, an infrastructure spending package, or standalone bills. The Housing Trust Fund, as you may know, is the first new federal resource in a generation and is exclusively targeted to serving people with the greatest needs. We are tracking every dollar of Housing Trust Fund money that is going out to cities and states, and we're really pleased to see that it's going to good use. The apartments that have been built so far, 2,000 units with the first round of funding, are housing some of our most vulnerable families, youth aging out of the foster care system, people who have been chronically homeless, veterans with traumatic brain injuries, survivors of domestic violence. So this program's just getting started, and we're looking forward to all the great work that you and others are doing to put that money to good use. Most recently, we also achieved funding for a new voucher mobility program. So that's 5,000 new vouchers for families with children to help them move to areas of opportunity connected to good schools, good jobs, transit, and healthcare. So all told, all of the work that many of you have done in this room means that we're now housing 100,000 more people than we did 2 years ago. 100,000 people who would have been sleeping in their cars, on the streets, or spending far too much of their income on rent. There are also 5 million low-income families who can sleep a little easier at night knowing that they won't be subject to cruel rent increases proposed by the administration. When I was here last year, in fact, Secretary Carson had proposed this biggest and top priority of his, raising rents and putting burdensome work requirements on low-income people. He's still trying to move that proposal forward. But together, we've largely stopped that effort in its tracks. And these wins, oh, please, yes. And these wins are a testament to the power of advocacy and the work of us to align our advocacy in new and different ways. This year, I think we have 4 major opportunities in Congress to move ahead with expanding housing resources. The first is through the budget process. So we are focusing all of our effort to make sure that housing programs get the most resources as possible, but we have a major challenge. Congress is debating whether or not to lift the low spending caps that have been put in place since 2011 that have made it nearly impossible for Congress to fund housing programs at the level needed. The question really is whether Congress will reach a bipartisan agreement to lift these caps, by how much, and how much will housing programs receive. Unfortunately, the same sort of dynamics that were at play last year when we saw the longest ever government shutdown are still in place. President Trump is still calling for even more funding for the wall between the U.S. and Mexico. Democrats are in no mood to compromise on that. And Democrats are poised to try to take away that last resort of a national emergency declaration to prevent Trump from shifting money from one source to another to pay for the wall. We're also starting to see something of a fracture within the Democratic Party at the national level, along the lines of what we saw among the Republican Party when they were in control of the House, where the Freedom Caucus folks and more moderate Republicans were split on edge. That adds a whole level of complexity about what might happen and when it will. But ultimately, I think that Congress will reach a deal, maybe in the fall, when the debt ceiling also has to be reached, or else we'll have a default. That means that it's on all of us to be reaching out to our members of Congress to push them to lift the spending caps and to use that as an opportunity to expand housing programs as much as possible. We also see an opportunity to get additional funds on top of the HUD budget this year. In the past, when Congress reached those bipartisan agreements, they set aside additional funds for high priorities like children's health. And this year, the National Low-Income Housing Coalition and others are pushing for a $5 billion set aside on top of HUD's budget. That would mean $4 billion for new vouchers and $1 billion in public housing repair. We think this is a major investment that could really move the dial forward, even though we know there's much more to be done. The second opportunity to increase housing resources is through an infrastructure package, but it's really on us to educate Congress about why housing is infrastructure, just like roads and bridges, and why any infrastructure package must include resources to build deeply affordable homes for people living in poverty. Investing in deeply affordable housing infrastructure through new construction and preservation bolsters economic growth. It provides long-term assets that help connect people to opportunity, supports local job creation and increase incomes, and can create inclusive communities. If we invest in a way that is equitable, it can mean that all people in our community can benefit. So to that end, we're calling for a $15 billion funding for capital housing repair, $5 billion for the National Housing Trust Fund, and $2 billion for rural and tribal housing to build deeply affordable homes for people with the greatest and most severe needs. There may also be a bipartisan push in that infrastructure deal to push localities to look at their zoning and land use regulations. I think we're finally seeing widespread recognition that for too long, local communities have used zoning regulations to reinforce NIMBYism, to re-entrench racial segregation, and to bar low-income people from neighborhoods, with broad negative impacts and disruptive impacts on all people in housing markets. And we're finally seeing a movement among Republicans and Democrats in Congress to do something about that. Democrats hope to vote on an infrastructure package by Memorial Day, so that gives us a short window of time, and we'll need your help to make the case for why housing resources should be included. It's unclear when or if the Senate will take this up, but it's something that you could possibly see a deal between House Democrats and the White House to put pressure on Senate Republicans to move ahead. The third opportunity is to expand housing resources when Congress reforms Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The administration has signaled that they plan to move forward with reforms, although it's unclear exactly who will be leading that effort. But we do know that Maxine Waters, who now leads the House Financial Services Committee, and the Banking Committee Chairman Mike Crapo have said that this is a top priority. In the past, when bipartisan deals have been put forward to reform Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they included at least $3.5 billion for the Housing Trust Fund, and we want to make sure that's the starting point for negotiations as part of a longer conversation about how do we ensure that there's access and affordability throughout the entire housing market. And lastly, we're also seeing congressional committees move forward on legislation and putting more attention on the housing crisis, especially through Chairwoman Waters. For the first time in years, she's held hearings on homelessness, rural housing, improvements to CRA, fair housing issues, and we're seeing her move legislation forward in her committee. Finally, I think the last opportunity to expand housing resources is through a tax extenders package. That's a fancy way of saying continuing tax breaks that we thought were gone. That gives us an opportunity to move some or pieces of, or the whole thing, of the Cantwell-Hatch low-income housing tax credit bill that would both expand and reform that program. A lot of that depends on how high in the list of priorities LIHTC is for Democrats when they're negotiating, and what Republicans are willing to trade for it. And so it's on us, again, to make sure that Democrats put that higher on their list. But beyond these specific legislative opportunities, there's something else that's happening in D.C. that I haven't seen since my time here. All of a sudden, you see members of Congress who are looking not just to work around the edges of the housing crisis, but to tackle it head on with bold and ambitious solutions. The size and scope of these bills are unlike anything I've seen. Senator Warren and Gillibrand, along with other several leaders in the House, have proposed $45 billion a year in the National Housing Trust Fund and other programs to build 3 million new, deeply affordable apartments over the next 10 years. Economists say that that will not only help America's poorest families, but will help lower rents by 10% across the board, an amazing feat when we're seeing housing costs continue to rise. Senator Booker and Harris have put together proposed renters tax credit bills that would give low-income families a much-needed tax break. Both bills would give a tax credit to any renter who is paying more than 30% of their income on rent. Harris's bill would also allow you to receive that tax break on a monthly basis, so that would help poor families make ends meet when rent is due. And Booker's bill pushes cities and states to start addressing their local barriers that push up housing costs and restrict supply. There are a lot of other really big housing bills coming soon. I wish I could share more details with you, but they're equally ambitious and badly needed, tackling everything from evictions, homelessness, to bold investments in developing and preserving housing. After decades of chronic underinvestment by Congress, it's remarkable to see presidential candidates who are using their platform to elevate this issue and solutions. In part, this is because we know that the crisis is so severe and is reaching new levels, but in part, it's because all of our collective work to put pressure on them to look for solutions. And we're seeing major candidates talking up their housing platforms in living rooms and town halls in New Hampshire, Iowa, South Carolina, and beyond. These first few months of the presidential election season, and I know that's hard to believe because it seems like we're so far away, we're seeing more attention on housing than we ever have in past presidential campaigns in history. It's truly, truly remarkable. But we need to build on this change in Washington, and that starts with engaging senators and representatives in new and exciting ways. The National Low-Income Housing Coalition last year launched our Opportunity Starts at Home campaign, where we decided housing is too important to just leave it up to housers. We need to bring in other constituents to make the argument for us and with us. So we've brought together top leaders from education, healthcare, civil rights, child welfare, criminal justice, many other sectors, to push Congress for bold investments in housing. And trust me, when you go to an office and they might not care about housing, but they care about education a lot, it means so much to have teachers in the room who are making the case for their students who get evicted from their homes and have to change school districts time and again. We also need to look at the housing crisis in new ways, ways that are different or new to the housing field in general. We need to address race and racial inequality and how that leads to housing instability. Thanks to groundbreaking research and analysis by Mark Jones and others, we know that African Americans experience homelessness at a far, far higher rate than similarly poor white families. African Americans represent 13% of the population, but 40% of homeless people, and 50% of homeless families. There's growing evidence from Matt Desmond that evictions aren't just about poverty, they're also about race. In Milwaukee, he found that black women were evicted at 3 times the rate as white women in the city, And new research from the Eviction Lab shows that 9 out of the 10 cities with the highest eviction rates are cities that have at least a 30% black population. So the bottom line is that people of color are dramatically more likely than whites to experience evictions and homelessness in the United States. And we can't address racial inequities until we address housing, and we can't address housing inequities until we address race. So we have a lot of challenges and a lot of work ahead at all levels of government. I'd love to encourage local governments here in Denver and beyond to continue to make their own investments, to leverage federal dollars, and to encourage state governments to do the same. I was surprised to find out that Colorado is one of only 10 states that doesn't have a state housing trust fund or one that's underfunded or unfunded. Knowing what we know about the huge gaps in housing for people living in poverty, local governments have to be creative to get more of this housing into the pipeline through direct investments of dollars. The shortage of deeply affordable housing is caused by a market failure. It doesn't make sense for developers to build housing that is that deeply, deeply affordable. The rents that they take in wouldn't be enough to keep the lights on in the property. And so the only way to address this market failure is for local, state, and federal governments to target resources to where they're needed the most. And local governments can be a part of a plan to combat NIMBYism and to build the political will across communities to ensure that everyone has a safe, decent, and affordable place to live. Lastly, local governments need to start tackling land use and zoning barriers that artificially restrict supply and drive up housing costs for everyone. We've seen Minneapolis, the first city in the nation, take on major zoning reforms to increase density and reduce racial segregation. Efforts are underway in California and Oregon and other communities across the nation. Reforming local zoning and land use laws is the single most powerful tool your local government has to reduce housing costs for the middle class, but it also allows local governments to then redirect and target their resources that are already limited on the poorest households. Cities also have a role to play when it comes to ensuring development without gentrification and displacement. And that's a conversation that we had earlier in a breakout panel. I was really pleased to see that such deep conversations were taking place here. As you know, the housing crisis is reaching new heights. We need everyone, all levels of government, developers, impacted people, nonprofits, working together to end homelessness and housing poverty. I want to thank you so much for the work that you guys are doing here at the local level and continue to make bold progress. Thank you so much for having me here. Appreciate it. And I'll open it up for questions if people have any about what's happening at the federal level. I think a mic runner is coming right to you.
I didn't hear you mention the word equity. Half of the people who are homeless are families, and half of those families are single women head of households, and we have yet to produce any legislation in Congress that deals with the whole issue of equity of pay, and of also the fact that men oftentimes, and people who look like me, unfortunately, dominate the entire wealth of our country. What can we say about how we can deal with that subject in Washington or anywhere? I don't care where.
Yeah, that's a great question. Equity is a huge important issue. I mentioned that we can't address housing inequality without talking about equity as well. I think you're getting at maybe income inequality as well. It's going to take bold investments to address the housing crisis. The shortage that we have is too large to just place on just local governments or just state governments, just federal governments, just the private sector working together. We need bold investments, and that means we need to spend more to do it. I'm really excited to see proposals from Elizabeth Warren, Senator Booker, Senator Harris, that are not nibbling at the edges, and the more pressure we can put on Congress to look at those proposals. You know, I'm not saying that those are going to become enacted anytime soon, but the more pressure and support we can build for proposals like that means that pieces of it can start moving in Congress.
We have a question here to your left.
Hi, thank you for the presentation. I think it really gave us some things to think about, but we also have some opportunities that are lying right in front of us. So I'm just curious from your perspective, What, if anything, can we as local governments and as housers, as folks that are involved in the conversation around housing, how can we leverage opportunity zones to really help either fill the gap that we're missing around housing or think about things a little bit differently?
That's a really difficult conversation to have. I think many of us are waiting to see what happens with opportunity zones. I think there's a potential enormous risk that they could fuel gentrification. I think a lot of it has to do with how that's implemented at the local level. I think there's a lot of things that cities can be doing about pooling together funds to pool that money to make sure that it's being done in an equitable way and that doesn't cause displacement. But I think it's really early and a lot of us are looking at ways to do that. You on the local level can be working with your city council about how to make sure that when opportunity zones are cited and the money is flowing, that it's flowing with affordable housing in mind. I think there's some people who are really hopeful that maybe opportunity zones could help build affordable housing as well. I'm a little skeptical of that. And so it's something that we're paying really close attention to.
Hi, you had mentioned at the national level the Democrats and this kind of potential rift within the Democratic Party. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that. And also about how, you know, at the national level, you all talk about housing to Republicans and sort of how you message it in a more bipartisan way as well.
Yeah, great. So the rift we're seeing, I think we just saw play out last week when House Democrats tried to move a budget resolution forward in the House. And Democrats thought it was going to be an easy vote and that it would sail to the Senate and put pressure on the Senate to do something accordingly or to take it up. But you are seeing sort of, it's harder to govern than to be in the minority in Congress. And the divisions among Republicans come to play out. So when Republicans were in control of the House, you saw a lot of folks in the Freedom Caucus refuse to vote for legislation unless it cut spending more or whatever else they wanted to achieve. The end result was that it actually pushed the moderate Republicans to look to Democrats for votes. It gave Democrats enormous leverage in deciding what our budget caps would be for the year or other policies. It's not clear right now what the impact will be if there is this divide within the Democratic Party. Would that shift some power back to moderate Republicans? I think it has to be seen. We're at the very beginning stages of it. On the other hand, maybe it pushes Democrats more to the left because they have to secure those votes. But it's all about how do you get to 218 to pass legislation, and the easiest way to do it is what Nancy Pelosi and others are going to be looking at. So that fracture could play kind of both ways, so it adds a little, makes it harder to predict what's gonna happen. For Republicans, we actually have a lot of support for housing among Republicans, although it's hard sometimes for them to be very vocal publicly about that support. Oftentimes we're asking them to do things behind the scenes to weigh in with their leadership, et cetera, about housing, but maybe not to be on something like public, like a bill. I think that the way that we talk about housing, at least the Low-Income Housing Coalition, we've always focused on housing for the very poorest households. And to a certain extent, the Republicans that we work with are ones that understand that there's a market failure. That means that there isn't a private sector solution to housing that's that deeply affordable. And in many ways, we've been able to bridge that relationship. One example is Mark Calabria, who's now the director of FHFA that oversees Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. He had done a joint op-ed with our CEO calling for maybe not new increases to housing, but a realignment of how housing resources are spent to focus them more on the lowest income households. So there's some opportunity there, I think, to build on that. Certainly a lot of Republicans are concerned about economic growth and job creation, and those are sort of the things that I emphasize when I talk to them.
Sarah, you have another question in the back right.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I work for a Center for Independent Living for People with Disabilities. And one of the things that we're finding is, especially with increased baby boomers, is a real need for true accessible housing. We get calls every day looking for accessible housing, and it's very, very difficult to find. Is that being addressed on a federal level, specifically with things like universal design and aging in place?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think a lot of those questions are addressed at the local level rather than at the federal level, but we do see that the people who have the greatest housing needs tend to be the lowest income seniors and people with disabilities and families working at low wages. So there's an effort behind putting more resources behind that housing. We saw 50,000 new housing vouchers that came online last year for people with disabilities. But I haven't heard much talk about making sure that when housing is built, even with federal dollars, that it is universally designed. It might be happening, but I'm just not aware of it.
To follow up with that, how can we at the local level help support housing being built with accessibility or visitability or universal design in mind?
Right. A lot of those decisions are made at your local level through your city council or through the housing plans that they put together, consolidated plans with your state QAP, your qualified action plan when it comes to low-income housing tax credit dollars. That's a really good avenue for you to be advocating when they are deciding how to spend the dollars to make sure that that's a key piece of that. Okay. Any other questions?
You have one more across the room.
Just making you run back and forth.
I'm getting there.
Yeah, thanks. I'm a member of your organization, so I wanted to ask with regards to the National Low Income Housing Coalition, how is your membership growing across the country, and how are you getting input from the membership?
That's a great question. We saw a huge amount of increase in interest in housing programs after the 2016 election, I think in part because we realized that much of the safety net, not just housing, was going to be at risk, and that has been true. We have over 1,000 organizational members across the country and a subscriber list of about 60,000. I want to encourage all of you guys to sign up to become members or to sign up for a listserv for information about how you can engage with your members of Congress and when is the best time to do that. We engage with our local organizations in a lot of different ways. Housing Colorado is one of our state partners that we work through a lot. But we also have other avenues. So all of our members are open to join our policy committee where we go to ask questions and get feedback about policy. A lot of things make a lot of sense. You know, it's very clear our mission is on the lowest income people, and sometimes it's clear what the position should be, but we always want to make sure that we're turning to people most impacted when making policy decisions that might not be clear. We also do that through having a board that requires that at least a quarter of our members are low-income people who are either living in or in need of federally assisted housing. And with that, I'll turn it over to our next speaker. I'm really pleased to introduce Michael McAfee, the president and CEO of Policy Link. That's a national research and action institute advancing racial and economic equity. When I have talked to him about what he thinks is needed in this role, he said the fundamental question at hand is whether or not he is personally and organizationally worthy of leading in this precise moment. I believe he is, so please help me join me in welcoming Dr. Michael McAfee.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me here today. It is really a pleasure to be someplace where actually you're doing deep results-based work. And so before I start, I wanted to applaud you on your leadership in the housing space. And at the same time I'm applauding you, I can still feel my heart racing because I know how much more needs to happen. And so what I want to talk to you about today is what I think is so important for us if we're going to strengthen our democracy, and that is, how do we build power that is centered in the people that we're privileged to be able to serve? And it may sound in some instances like I'm having a conversation with you where you could put me on the political spectrum, But I'm going to ask you to try to hold and not do that, because I don't find the political spectrum to be relevant right now. I find that it's getting in the way. And so when I'm talking to you, I'm not talking to you because of some ideology politically. I'm talking to you based on the gift that I've had to come up out of poverty and to still be, in many cases, suffering from the guilt of that, because opportunity is still too random in America. And because in many instances, and when we have these conversations about the solutions that we want to address, there are a couple things that I find that are in the way. And one of them that it seems to be emerging again in our conversations is this notion of power. Who has it, how it gets manifested, and how it gets used. And so I'm going to share some things with you that I hope you can take away that can kind of accelerate your work. And for me, this is very much about me owning and stepping into my power, because I think it's essential for each and every one of you in this room to do that if you're going to be able to address what needs to be addressed in this nation. And the first thing I want you to do is to get clear about what is your number. My number is 100 million. That's 1 in 3 Americans who are economically insecure in America. And the reason why that number is so important to me is because as I've stepped into my role as president and CEO of PolicyLink 6 months ago, I've been struggling with this question of how not to get seduced by the role and how to not get seduced into thinking that showing up here is my work. Because the reality is, at a national organization, you can fly all over the country and you can write all the wonderful reports and people will applaud you for that. But there's a couple of things that I know are essential if I'm going to show up that I need to express. And the first is to be clear that the issues that we're talking about are really a design challenge that was intentional. That the issues that we're struggling with right now are the result of a design challenge that was intentional. And one of the unintended consequences of this design is that the nation now is actually too toxic for the majority of us. I mean, I remember coming to Denver in the 80s and the 90s when it was on the come up. And now I look at it and folks in the middle class has to decide, can you afford that apartment or that condo or that home and public education or private school? In many cases, you gotta make a decision because we've neglected the public education infrastructure in so many of our places. So many of our cities, people actually have to make the trade-off. Can't live in these booming cities anymore if they've got kids because they can't actually afford private education and the rent and the mortgage. That's a consequence of our neglect. It's a consequence of our racial neglect. We started neglecting public education for a very specific reason. And now, while many of us have forgotten that reason, it now has created a space that many of us can't participate in our own cities as they boom. And I'm sharing that with you because in so many cases, this moment is still about that. Opportunity zones, in my mind, is an example of the still the continued threats. And there was a word used about messaging that I think is still a part of the threat. I actually don't believe you can message your way out of this. Because I don't know if I'm ever gonna make you be comfortable with black folks. I don't know how you message that. If you don't want me to live next to you, you don't want me to live next to you. If black folks don't want to live next to Asians or Mexicans, I don't know how you message that to black folks. Some of this is that we've gotten too fancy by half. Do we want to be in relationship with each other? Do we actually want to design communities that work for everyone? That is the call. And waiting 20 years for someone to get comfortable with the concept of paying women equitably, waiting 20 years for someone to get comfortable so that you can say black folks, waiting 20 years so that we can get comfortable seeing our disability population in our communities undercuts the very results you want to get. And that's why I'm excited here, because I think Denver in many instances has an opportunity to help the nation get beyond being stuck in the ways you hear me describing. You have an opportunity to lead the nation. And so I don't want you to miss this point. This is a place, this is a state where a lot of good stuff is happening. And what I want you to begin to think about is, can you hold the interest of all of your people? That's what this moment is about. Can you center the most vulnerable? Can you listen to their voice, wisdom, and experience? Because they've been telling you for years what they need. They've been telling you about their pain for years, and now it's time to stop fetishizing that pain by having them come to our lunches and tell us about their story, writing our annual reports and using their image. It is time for us to exercise the radical imagination and the power necessary to say, you know what, no matter what room I walk in and no matter how you might respond to it, there is no shame in me actually wanting to do work for the most vulnerable, the same way I do for the middle class, developers, rich folks, etc. That there is no shame in that. We are beyond having to apologize for who we want to serve. To me, that is a manifestation of power. Now, what you choose to do is up to you. So I'm not telling you what to do. What I'm telling you is what my personal journey is and where I'm seeing opportunities and things take off across the country. I'm on the road about 70% of the time. So I see a lot of this country and not just the major cities. And where I can tell you folks are stuck is because they find a lot of ways to talk around what the fundamental issues are that are actually barriers to the results. You know you can produce affordable housing. That's technical and important. But can you actually have the conversation around the type of community you want? Where love is manifested because it includes all and everyone can belong in it. That is the adaptive conversation for us to have right now. Do we want to build that? The adaptive conversation for us to have for those of us who are institutional leaders is, do we want to increase the capacity of our institution to actually serve everyone? Do we want to do that work? Our institutions are the foundation to a strong democracy. And in too many cases, no matter where you sit on the political spectrum, our institutions have conflated acts of charity with the transformative change, the structural change that is needed to liberate this nation. This is not a charity moment, folks. This is not a charity moment. And while charity is needed, what I'm asking you to think about is having the radical imagination actually to create the conditions so that charity is not needed. That's what this moment is. When I tell you my number, 100 million, and that would be millions in Colorado, you can see why charity is not needed. Because charity won't get your numbers going in the right direction. So for all those data conversations you're in, all those folks who want to see those pretty charts, I'm going to give you the tagline so that you can just save your money. It's going to stay awful. It's going to stay awful. I don't care how many more consultants you hire, how many more folks you become infatuated with and start reading their book and talking about what they're writing about these days. That is actually work avoidance. Because the work for us is to get into a different relationship with each other so that we can enact a new possibility. And that possibility is actually to win on the stuff that we care about, to win on actually finishing the unfinished business of making this democracy just and fair for everyone. That's what we can do. Now, some people would say, that's crazy, Michael. You're just dreaming. The nation was founded on dreams. The progress that we've getting made to move beyond some of the structural flaws in how this nation was founded were dreams. Women having the right to vote was a dream. Civil rights was a dream. Gay marriage was a dream. Having a higher standard of living than any other place in the world was a dream. And what I get sad about is that too many of us have stopped dreaming. Too many of us have stopped dreaming. What I want you to think about is, what would it be like for you to fully step into your power, regardless of your role? Regardless of your role, regardless of what you think people might think, but to actually channel your God-given gifts to actually do something that is far more powerful with them. That's the opportunity. I'm not having a conversation with you about technical things around housing, because what I know is what we do know how to do, we do know how to build housing. We know how to preserve it. We know how to innovate on it. And the question is, but do we have the will to do it? Do we have the will to do that? So I'm not trying to have a technical conversation with you, because if I thought data and reports would do it, PolicyLink would have been out of business 20 years ago. So I am clearly convinced now that this is not just a rational exercise. Even when we bring the rigor, even when people will say, Michael, don't talk about equity, don't talk about race, it always ends up there somehow. Now, in this moment, some days I'm deeply saddened by what I see. But mostly, I'm enormously optimistic. I'm optimistic because while you may not all see it, when I'm traveling around, I'm seeing folks struggle with making their organizations more inclusive. I'm seeing folks who I thought would never speak up and say what needs to happen. I'm seeing young people and on the ground, I'm seeing grassroots organizers usher in a host of new policies all across this country and fight for what they want. I'm seeing in places where folks are actually trying to limit democracy by curbing people's capacity to vote in other ways, that folks are pushing back on that stuff. And that's why I'm talking to you about power. Because I actually want you to think about, what is the power that you have to think about, what do you center? What is centered? I'm in about five or six national narrative conversations right now. And in one of these meetings, it got really real the other day. I was in New York, and I was getting really frustrated in the meeting because I don't know how you do narrative work when you don't even know who you're talking about. Changing the narrative. So this is all going on, and all this money is being spent on narrative work. And I asked the fundamental question, how do you change the narrative for someone who is afraid of me on site? How do you change the narrative for folks who want to design an oppressive nation that excludes and denies opportunity? How do you do that? Because we're not having that conversation. You're telling me you want to come up with a new fancy ad campaign. But in many cases, we're not doing the work in our communities because of the barriers that we're comfortable with. Those people. Do we want them to live next to us? Do we want them to worship with us? Do we want them to go to our schools, our restaurants, play in our parks? Those are the questions that we struggle with. And I know this firsthand, working 11 years at HUD and watching the development in Chicago and Cabrini Green, and watched how a community, without saying very much, made it absolutely inhospitable for folks to move back to their homes. Made it inhospitable and didn't have to say a word. This is our equity moment, folks. This is it. And I'm buoyed by the people in this room, your leadership, your vision, your capacity to be of service. It's what keeps me hopeful. But I'm not just hopeful, I'm really imploring you to think about that 1 in 3 Americans. That's a lot of pain and suffering. And while it's playing out on the political spectrum, the reason why I say don't let the political spectrum get in the way, if I'm in Appalachia or the Mississippi Delta or Oswego, Kansas, wherever I'm at, or the big cities, the issues are all the same. The issues are all the same. Context may be a little different, but the issues are all the same. And in this moment, if you're going to advance housing, build communities of opportunity at the scale that is necessary, someone in this room has to imagine that we can design a new world. We seem to be one of the only few sectors that don't want to manifest radical imagination. Elon Musk is sending rockets to the moon and back and all this into orbit and landing them and all that. We're sequencing the genome. We're doing all this amazing work in all of these other disciplines. And yet we can't figure out how to live together. That's crazy as hell. This is crazy as hell. But it's true. And so when we think about power, there's a couple of specific points I'm going to share with you that I want you to hold. The first is manifest power in for what purpose? Yeah, you can build your wealth. Yes, you can build your home. Yes, you can hoard opportunity for your family and future generations. You can do all of that. But to me, I think you build that power so that you can actually manifest love. Love through how your institution serves, love through how you serve. I don't think that's soft at all. I think that's the work for our generation. It's not soft. That's the first thing. Can you manifest power to embody love in your institution and in your service? That's the first thing. Can you actually embrace the most vulnerable in your community and bring them into your charge? Can you hold their interest if you're in the White House or Congress or the boardroom the same way you do when you're in their community? That's real power. When you can hold their interest and not apologize for it. Especially when it's not easy to do. That's real power. Can you share it by knowing when to be quiet and let someone else take on this fight because you're afraid to or don't want to? That's real power. Can you think about what it would be like for your organization to get in a different relationship with other institutions and present a new possibility other than just applying for the grants that are available? Imagine if you redesigned the housing ecosystem in this city so that it actually could meet the demand and not just participated in the ecosystem that exists, because it's been designed inefficiently. We're one of the only other sectors, few sectors, that doesn't actually have to think about redesigning the market so that it can perform more effectively. What would happen if those of you in this room decided to say, you know what? What would it look like if we really asked the question, how do we actually scale our housing impact versus who's available to work with? It's a very different question. Leads you down very different roads. Those are the questions that I'm struggling with. What should my impact be today versus what do I have money to do? It has me in very different conversations with my funders. In some cases, it's having me tell them I don't want their money. And the reason why I don't want their money is because even though I can do good work, PolicyLink would be irrelevant in the next 3 years. Think about that for a moment. I could be doing good work and still irrelevant. Because in many cases, the work that is paid for isn't the work that's needed in this moment. And the real power is to reorient that conversation and not see myself in a different power relationship because I'm talking to an investor, but to be able to engage in a different conversation that gets us on another journey around what is the shared impact that we want to have? And can we think about another way to get there than this transactional relationship? I saw the housing report that you all produced. That is amazing work. That's a lot of work, folks. This is a lot of work. And what you hear me suggesting to you is that if you think about the conditions that are ripe for leading this nation, it's ground zero. And you also are hearing me try to bring things into this room that people have decided to get unanchored from, like manifesting love, like talking about all people and actually meaning all people, actually having the audacity to want to dismantle structures that are oppressive in our spaces. This is what the nation's housing agenda is all about. It's not just about housing. Because if you don't do this and you just build housing, you're going to gentrify it. You're going to push everybody out. All you have to do is go to San Francisco, the most progressive city and the most progressive state in the country, has barely 6% black folks. How could that be when we're always snubbing our noses at Mississippi and Alabama, when they actually have some far more progressive policies? Think about that. There was no mass exodus. There was no forced exiling of black folks out of San Francisco. They didn't load the middle class up, whether you were white, black, or whatever, and put them on buses and ship them out of San Francisco, but you can't hardly find them. How many of you all been to San Francisco lately? You know what I'm talking about. When 120,000 plus is considered low income. This is what happens when you keep designing a city so that you can protect your little world because you're protecting it from those people, even though you say you're progressive. And 20 years later, you look up, and now your generation can't even stay there. That's what we're building in this nation all across the country. And that's why I said I'm not on the political spectrum right now, because we're getting ready to do the same thing in Oakland where I live and where our corporate offices are. If you look at Oakland right now, from the lakefront to about 27th Street, 23,000 units of housing are getting ready to come on the market. Average rent starts at around $4,500. Who do you think that's for? And while I'm privileged to afford it, what does that mean for the folks who made Oakland, Oakland, who gave it its verve and its culture and its vibrancy? They're moving 20, 30 miles out of the city now. These are the very folks who need to be connected to the transportation routes, to be connected to the jobs. And now they're pushed out of the city again, progressively, just lovingly neglecting the most vulnerable. And yet we want to talk about what Republicans do. We need to really check our political discourse right now because it's not serving us well. It's not serving us well. And yes, even when I say this at my staff, at my office, my staff breaks out in hives. The work now is not what you would consider pure political work. This moment is harder than that. This moment is for me to see my fate inextricably bound with yours, even though you may be afraid of me. That's hard as hell to do, but that's the reality. Your job is to overcome your fear of me and see your fate interconnected with mine. All of our jobs is to ask ourselves, who do we not see in our community? Who do we not see? Who needs to be in our employ? And how do we create the space to bring them in? You have the agency to do that. And what I'm asking you to think about is take it up now and watch what it ushers in. You can hire who you want today. I asked our HR person, who do we not see? And you'd be surprised. We actually don't see the average American at a progressive shop like PolicyLink. Don't see them. We hire from the best schools in the country. If that was the case, how I came through, I would have never worked at PolicyLink. Think about that for a moment. A person who didn't originally have the pedigree that PolicyLink hires for now runs PolicyLink. And the reason why I'm telling you that, because if I don't stop and ask the question of who do we not see, I won't even see me. I won't even see me. And I could be running around here telling white folks all that they can do. But I will miss actually seeing myself. So that meant we had to start figuring out, how do we have interns at state schools? How do we have internships for folks who aren't even in school but are doing amazing results-based work in community? You could imagine the culture shift. But I thought we were an equity organization. Folks, it is liberating when you can get out of these boxes that we've set up and realize that every last one of us in this room has work to do. You will accelerate equity. I'm telling you my own journey of accelerating it in my own shop, because it's too often to just situate this on the black-white spectrum. You can't imagine all the conversation around expressing our pronouns, what that caused in our organization. And I come from Kansas City, Missouri, so you know, I'm not even hip to all the pronouns and things and forms of identity. But the reason why I'm sharing that with you is because it really doesn't matter. I don't need to be hip to it. Whether I get it, whether I don't, whether I'm hip to it or not is inconsequential. What matters is, will I create the space for that person to belong? Do I see them as worthy of my attention and to be in relationship with me? And that is the journey of manifesting your power. This is not a technical solution that's going to get us out of this. Each and every one of you in this room can set a journey for the next 20 years that will transform this nation if we get this point. We've written enough, we've done enough PowerPoints, we've done enough data reports. We've been intoxicated by the problem too long. This is a moment for you to step back and have the audacity to think about creating a democracy that is actually just and fair for all. That's our unfinished business. Don't be asleep at the wheel on that. Because while you might be asleep at the wheel, there are others who are making sure that they design a nation that turns this place into South Africa. And that is real. And I can't actually be mad at them for fully participating in democracy by expressing their power. I can't be mad at them for doing that. If my own people, meaning all of those of us in this room who say we care about the most vulnerable, day in and day out, deny our own people. Can't do this work. So what I'm asking you to think about as I close, Don't be dismayed by the heat of this political moment. That is what a democracy is about. Don't be dismayed by it. Do the thing that in many cases we have chosen not to do, which is to have the audacity to own this nation, own our power, and design a future that is structural and policy-oriented, that is not just charity-oriented. Folks, we can play in the structural space. We can act and enact public policy. We can do those things, even if you are 501c3 up to the limit. Go up to the damn limit and then tell me about it. Can you just do that? Go up to the limit. Just do that. I'll make you all a bet. If you don't even consider the things I'm telling you, you will be back here in 5 years and this will be worse. I guarantee you. Because in the early stages, there's no guarantee that it's going to get better because the problem is so severe. This is going to be an arc of change that must be as enduring as the arc to construct it to be oppressive. And what I'm asking you to think about is, lay out that arc of change. Figure out what new infrastructure you need that needs to be enduring to support that arc of change. Figure out how your leadership voice needs to be different in this moment. Figure out the relationships, the different ways in which you've got to get in relationship with people to have the impact that you want. And resist the urge to keep bringing people into your community who are only confusing you. Because they allow you the space to keep avoiding the work. How many of you all ever went to counseling and you went because you simply wanted them to validate your position? That's what bringing in all these external consultants and experts do. The wisdom is in this room. I know that it is. I see it in community every day. The wisdom is here. Your faith orientation provides a path forward for you if you have one. Use it. Use whatever you got. If you don't have a faith orientation, use just simply the power of being in human relatedness. I'm telling you. Your problems are not so severe. You only have, I believe it's like 40% of renters are cost burden. That's still a significant number. I think it's like 49%. That's still significant. You can still change it. Only about 39% of the middle class here is cost burden. Yeah, you felt that too, huh? But those numbers don't even come close to what's happening in other places. So you're set up nicely. You're set up nicely to think about how to innovate. And the last thing I'll say to you is this. Innovation will require disruption. It will require you to disrupt the ways you do business, the relationships that you have. It will require you to operate at the edge of your competence and the height of being uncomfortable. So if you think you were going to do this work and be comfortable, that was a fantasy. And last but not least, I'll say this about power. If those of us in this room don't want to do the work, there's other ways. When folks go to the street, don't get mad at them for going to the street because we're not performing. There's other ways to advance democracy. But I'm always fascinated by those of us in this room who can offer a critique about others who choose to lead because we have been too feckless in our leadership. And when I say that, I'm going to leave you on these points to consider as you go back. Do you bring all the people into the room? Are you centering the solution or more centering the funder that you gotta appease? Are you centering whiteness over everything else? Are you centering whiteness over everything else? And I'm using that not as a negative, but as a dominant. And I'm asking us all to be clear about what we center. Because if it's not whiteness, it could be something else. So it doesn't mean just because if white folks weren't in charge or you're not centering that, you'll do it right. Just because the nation's becoming a nation of color does not mean we will get the equity question right. That's not a guarantee. And so my call is to all of us to get clear about if we want to get the equity question right as this nation becomes a nation of color, I'm asking you to step back from issues every day, because there's a gazillion issues that we could be talking about right now, all have a role to housing. But if you don't show up as a different leader, our institutions won't be able to serve. If you don't show up as a different leader, we're not going to be in the relationships that are necessary. But what I'm hopeful of is I'm seeing it. I'm seeing it, folks. So I'm asking you to stand in this storm, in this moment in our nation's evolution. Stand in the storm with your back straight. Have the courage to continue to create spaces for people to belong. I'm watching white folks speak with a voice that I've never heard. I'm watching white men show up in ways that I've never seen. I'm watching us actually find each other in ways that I've never seen happen before. And I'm sharing that with you because this is the moment where we can continue to lurch forward or we can continue to slide backwards. And so I'm applauding what you're doing in this room. And what I'm asking you to consider is to double down on that progress right now. When I talk about scale, hold can you get to 51% of the people who need it if you want a marker? Because if you use a marker like that, it's going to force you to get out of your comfort zone and do something radical. Hold your number. Think about scale as at least 51% of those who need it. Stand on the progress, pat yourself on the back, and know that the nation needs you to do more work. If this was hard, it would have already been done. Unfortunately, in this evolution, all the easy stuff has been done. This is a moment for us to do the work to build this nation. And I think it's a privilege to be able to be on this stage with you, to be able to hold the guilt of coming out of poverty, the pain of knowing that my sisters did not, and every day I hear about their stories through my mother. And how tragic if I spent my whole life trying to run away from something and then and now I'm privileged to be out of it and I wouldn't do my job. Or I couldn't see clearly how to do it. I'm sharing that with you because some of you all need to be reminded of the gift that is inside you. Unleash it. The last thing I will say in these few seconds, you know, when I started my career and first got out of poverty, after selling life insurance and selling it all to my family and didn't have anywhere else to sell to, I quit that job. I went and worked at a Sprint call center, quit that job because I thought I was going to die in that cubicle. I decided that I was going to go and just go for it. And I had a daughter when I was in college, and so I could have easily been one of these statistics. So I'm trying to pay child support. And I called the mother of my daughter up and said, hey, I'm just going to go for it. Because if I don't go for it now, I'll probably never make it. She said, okay. But this is how the system works. I took the mother of my daughter to court because I didn't want to just pay child support. I wanted to be a father. And since we weren't together, I didn't want to fight about it. But I didn't realize at the time when you don't pay child support, when you get over like $2,000, they come arrest you. So I'm working. I've quit my job. I'm struggling to go try to raise a $20 million endowment to seed innovations in education. If I couldn't do anything else, I had the street smarts enough to know how to sniff money and power out. I asked a Jesuit priest named Father Thomas Savage, would he help me with my nonprofit? He knew I wasn't going to raise the money, but he took me under his wing. I get a knock at my door. It's the police department that come to arrest me. Everything could have went crazy. I take all my little brochures and stuff down to the prosecutor and say, man, I'm trying to get out of poverty. Give me a chance. Prosecutor says, okay, I'll let you get on a payment plan. Father Savage, nobody knows what's going on. I'm just out here willing and dealing like everything's okay. He introduces me to a woman named Jan Kramer at the Greater Kansas City Community Foundation. Jan offers me a job, and I'm deeply offended because I thought she was co-opting me from my movement. But 6 months later, I'm about to get evicted. So she offers me a job again, and I take it. That started my career after I finished in the military. Overnight, I went from struggling to being a star because of my proximity to money and power. 5 years in, I was a director at the foundation, and I had the audacity to start asking the question around youth development. This is in the 90s when youth development was emerging. I had the audacity to ask a group of elites who had made my career, we don't need to have quality youth development programming take 20 years. Just put your children or grandchildren in it, and you will change it overnight. Because those of us with money have a buying option. And when we exercise it, we expect immediate response. But that's not the behavior I saw people having for those children. Overnight, I went from a star to an angry black man. They sent me to anger management to talk to a woman named Dr. Dottie Fannin still for a year. We talked about the reality of what has to happen in the world because, welcome to reality, Michael. I ultimately got fired from the foundation for pushing. And I had to leave Kansas City. I'm not 30 yet. I'm making nearly $100,000 in Kansas City. That's really good. To this day, my mother doesn't know why I left Kansas City. She wouldn't have understood anyway, but I didn't want to stress her out about what was happening. But I'm telling you the story about what happens when you step into your power. I got fired then, and I'm still doing the damn work. This is the same work I got fired to do in Kansas City. But I'm telling you that because it was one of the best experiences of my life. Because I had to choose. Just sit here and be a star and get whatever you want. You want to go to the White House and work, whatever you want, I could have got at the foundation. Or be of service. It was a really good memory. It allowed me to choose. That was in my 20s. And then in 2012, I was coming out of the station in Penn Station, and I tell you, I travel a lot, and I was having trouble breathing. And I sat down, I was like, man, I know I'm in shape. What's the problem? Fortunately, I was staying over in DC, and I went to the CVS MinuteClinic, and they were closed. Went back, the line was too long. Fortunately, I was talking to my mother on the phone. She said, why don't you just go to the hospital? Fortunately, I listened to my mother. Go to the hospital, they're talking to me, I'm not hurting or anything, just short of breath. They keep asking me the same questions. Finally, another resident comes in, he asks me a different set of questions, discover I'm traveling, they put iodine in my veins. Usually one blood clot will kill you. But the blood clot apparently had traveled from my leg to my lungs, and it was in both of my lungs. And it wasn't one, it was a lot of them. And so I'm sitting in, I can't leave DC for a month. But I'm sitting in the hospital bed, happy as hell. I'm happy again because I was another one of those gifts of, where are you at, Michael? Are you doing what you're supposed to be doing? I wasn't sitting there like, oh man, God, you just let me live another day. I'm gonna get to this work. I was doing the work. I wasn't ready to check out, but I was living into my power. And it felt good. My wife flew out there. She's like, will you shut up about how good you are? She couldn't process what I was experiencing, which is the gift of clarity of really when you are in your power. And I'm sharing that with you because sometimes you get it in your 20s, but you never get it again. And I've been blessed to have it my whole career, even when I was in purgatory at HUD from getting fired in Kansas City. It was purgatory. I had to lick my wounds for a moment. But I'm telling you that, folks, Because when you are in your power, people can't stop you. And you will have the impact that you never thought you could have, even as an individual. But I'm sharing that also because I hope for someone in this room, you don't wait until it's too late to find that source of power and strength. What I was most happy about was that I was being of service, which that's the thing that makes my spirit the fullest. I'm asking you to recognize that if this nation is going to make a nation where everyone can participate, prosper, and reach their full potential, that that is the nexus of how we will find our way forward. To be of service to each other in this room. You do that, this nation will be just and fair. So thank you.